Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence, your Wednesday, July 1st, 2026, edition of the Macro, Geopolitics, and Investing Evening Edition.
Our central thesis today focuses on the accelerating fragmentation of global technology standards, a shift that is moving us from a period of seamless digital integration toward a structured, bipolar ecosystem. We are witnessing the end of the era of frictionless global scaling and the beginning of a more costly, partitioned digital reality.
It's no longer about who has the best code, but who controls the silicon.
The pattern is clear that brings us to our lead story, the intensifying reality of the great AI decoupling.
$1 trillion. That is the projected figure for hyperscaler capital expenditures next year. We are officially moving from the experimental phase of AI into the spend or die phase.
It's the trillion-dollar arms race, Maya. We're looking at a massive shift in the global economic architecture, specifically what we're calling the great AI decoupling. It isn't just about two different tech stacks, it's about two fundamentally different economic trajectories, the US-led expansion versus a highly contained deflationary China.
Decoupling. Such a polite way of saying we are building two separate planets that happen to share an orbit.
It's more of a K-shaped divergence. Chartbook flagged that while the US is seeing this massive credit-driven expansion, China is dealing with a massive walling in of wealth. They saw about $1 trillion in capital outflows in 2025 alone, and now they're facing a massive dam of under-allocated capital. We're talking about tens of trillions in Chinese wealth trapped in low-yield CNY deposits, because capital controls are essentially forcing investors to stay put.
So on one side, you have a US tech sector acting like a high-stakes casino, and on the other, you have Chinese investors essentially stuck in a high-security savings account.
Something to flag here, it's creating this massive imbalance. On the US side, we see these AI-powered conglomerates, think the modern incarnations of Google and Microsoft, using massive compute power to subsidize much riskier, lower-margin ventures like self-driving cars or logistics. Prof. G. Markets noted that these high-growth AI valuations actually act as a financial papering over mechanism. They allow the parent companies to mask the slim margins of their secondary businesses because investors are so intoxicated by the perceived infinite upside of the underlying AI infrastructure.
It's the don't look at the kitchen, look at the neon sign out front strategy.
Stepping back, that neon sign is getting incredibly expensive to power. We're seeing a structural releveraging wave in the investment-grade credit market. This isn't just high-yield junk bond territory. The sheer scale of the capex required by these hyperscalers is driving massive debt issuance right within the investment leverage sector. Credit crunch Wellington's Fitzgerald warned that we are facing a success paradox. If the technology advances so rapidly that AI models become commoditized, essentially turning into a utility like electricity, the pricing power disappears. If that happens, the economic viability of these highly leveraged infrastructure assets could collapse, mirroring the 2012-2016 US shale bust.
So we spend $1 trillion to build the world's most advanced brain, only to find out the brain is now a commodity you can buy for pennies on the dollar, leaving us with a mountain of very expensive, very useless hardware.
That is the exact risk. And the commoditization is already starting. Bloomberg Surveillance reported yesterday that the primary value proposition is shifting away from the models themselves, the architecture of things like OpenAI or Anthropic, and toward proprietary enterprise data and integration. The moat is no longer how good your LLM is, but how much unique, protected data you can feed it.
Which brings us to the awkward part of the decoupling. If the US is trying to build a moat using export controls, why are we suddenly seeing the walls come down?
It's a massive strategic ambiguity right now. Geopolitical Dispatch suggested that the US decision to lift export controls on Anthropic's Fable and Mythos models might actually be a strategic admission of failure in containment. It implies one of three things. Either Beijing has already achieved parity, the models don't actually pose the predicted security risks, or the US has intentionally degraded the tech to meet regulatory standards.
Or more simply, the edge we thought we had is evaporating because the technology is becoming too easy to replicate.
That's the harebrained versus tortoise debate. If a Chinese firm claims to have developed a Mythos-equivalent model at the same time the US lifts restrictions, the strategic value of unilateral trade restrictions drops toward zero. It signals that the high-end AI layer is commoditizing faster than the policy can keep up.
It sounds like we're moving toward a world where the US and China are just two different types of economic gravity. One is expanding through massive, leveraged, data-hungry compute, and the other is managing a massive, inward-facing, deflationary pressure.
And the middle ground is disappearing. Even the trade relationship looks cosmetic right now. Chartbook pointed out that American protectionism hasn't actually solved the trade deficit. It has just successfully diverted Chinese imports through third parties like Taiwan and Mexico. The underlying friction is still there, it's just being routed through different nodes.
And let's not forget the physical bottleneck. It's not just about software or policy, it's about the actual atoms.
Right, the supply side is incredibly inefficient. Prof. G. Markets highlighted that high bandwidth memory, or HBM, creates a massive bottleneck. The trade ratio is brutal. You need 4 times the wafer capacity to produce just 1 GB of AI-specific DRAM compared to the standard DDR5 you'd find in a regular PC. You can have the best algorithms in the world, but if you can't scale the physical memory, the whole expansion hits a hard ceiling.
So we have a massive leveraged infrastructure build-out, a shrinking technological edge, and a physical supply chain that is fundamentally inefficient. It's a lot of arrows all pointing toward a very complicated moment for the global credit markets.
It's a period of widening the aperture, to borrow a phrase from Top Traders Unplugged. We are moving into an era where non-human intelligence becomes a scientific framework, where everything from mycelial networks to advanced LLMs are part of a new, observable reality. But the cost of entering that reality is becoming a barrier to entry that only the largest, most leveraged players can even attempt to cross.
Investors in the investment-grade space need to start looking at those concentration limits very closely.
The real test will be the next round of earnings reports from the hyperscalers to see if that trillion-dollar capex is actually generating a return.
But if the infrastructure is already becoming a commodity, the real fight might move somewhere else entirely. Let's talk about where the money is rotating as these tech giants hit their limits. For the last 18 months, the only way to make money in the market was to buy whatever piece of silicon was currently being hyped on every social media feed. It was the era of the magnificent few, where if you weren't riding the Nvidia or Broadcom wave, you were basically just watching a very expensive bonfire.
But that concentrated trade is finally hitting a wall. We are seeing a fundamental rotation away from those overextended hyperscalers and moving into a much broader market expansion. The rate of change in semiconductor earnings has effectively peaked, meaning there aren't enough upside surprises left in the big names to drive the index higher on their own.
So the party is moving from the VIP lounge to the general admission floor.
As Mike Wilson of Morgan Stanley has been highlighting, we're seeing the S&P 1500 breadth expand significantly. It isn't just about the giants anymore. The median stock in the S&P 1500 is actually growing earnings at a double-digit pace, with top-line revenue growth hitting 7%. The real action is in the under-owned sectors, think consumer discretionary transports and regional banks.
It sounds lovely in theory, but I can't help but feel like we're just swapping one crowded room for another. Is this actually a structural shift, or are we just finding new ways to chase the same momentum?
It's more structural than that. According to Prof. G. Markets, the semiconductor outperformance is actually shifting into bottleneck investing. Investors are rotating out of the established leaders and into secondary constraints like memory, optical, and power semiconductors. The supply side is actually shielded from a correction right now because a shortage of clean rooms means new manufacturing capacity won't even come online until well into 2027.
So we aren't even playing with the same players. We're just playing with the people who sell the players their tools.
It's a telling detail. And this broader strength is being fueled by a very specific set of economic tailwinds. We are coming off a 3-year rolling recession, so the easy economic comparisons are working in favor of companies. Add in the current administration's focus on deregulation, tax cuts, and capex incentives, and you have a recipe for earnings growth that isn't dependent on a handful of tech giants.
Okay, let's pause. I'll admit, listening to the idea that we are simultaneously seeing fiscal dominance from massive deficits and a new monetary framework that might lead to deflation is a lot. It's like trying to drive a car where the accelerator is stuck to the floor because of the government, but the engine is simultaneously trying to freeze itself.
It sounds contradictory, but it's the new reality. As FICC Focus pointed out, U.S. economic growth and inflation are increasingly driven by fiscal dominance rather than monetary policy. The 7% to 9% fiscal deficits we've seen recently have effectively superseded the Fed's ability to steer the economy through interest rate tweaks. At the same time, Top Traders Unplugged suggested a new framework is emerging where increased money supply might actually lead to deflation, provided that massive technological breakthroughs continue to collapse the costs of energy, labor, and materials.
So the Fed is essentially a passenger in a car driven by the Treasury and a group of engineers.
That's one way to frame it. And the Fed's actual reaction function has narrowed. Their focus is now squarely on inflation. As long as inflation in housing, energy, and tariffs remains stable, the expectation is that the Fed will keep interest rates on hold for the remainder of 2026. If energy prices continue to decline, we could see lower than expected real rates, which provides a massive tailwind for equities.
But there's always a catch. There is always a but lurking in the fine print of these macro forecasts.
The but is liquidity. The primary near-term risk isn't actually interest rate hikes, it's a potential liquidity squeeze. The real economy is facing significant capital shortages for capex, and there is a very real fear that the Fed won't provide proactive balance sheet support to bridge that gap. If the Fed stays on the sidelines while companies need to fund massive infrastructure builds, the momentum could stall.
Which brings us back to the danger of being too clever. You start chasing these smaller, under-owned players because they look cheap, but you forget that in a tight spread environment, one bad move can wipe you out.
That's the path to hell is paved with carry principle. FICC Focus noted that chasing marginal income in low volatility environments leads to a dangerous compression of credit spreads. If you make a single incorrect credit call in this environment, the mathematical cost is disproportionately high. One error can negate an entire year's worth of alpha. It necessitates a defense wins championship strategy, prioritizing capital preservation over chasing every little bit of yield.
It's a lot of pressure on the individual investor to be both a macro strategist and a risk manager.
It is, but there is a stabilizing force. We're seeing a great handoff in fixed income demand. As FICC Focus argued, the U.S. household is emerging as the primary successor to the Federal Reserve in driving demand for bonds. As retirees shift their allocations to find attractive yields compared to the era of near-zero interest rates, it's creating a potentially decade-long positive flow environment for bonds.
So the volatility is coming, the Fed is stepping back, and the responsibility for keeping the bond market afloat is being handed to your grandmother's 401k.
It's certainly a more dynamic, less predictable system. With the era of forward guidance and predictable Fed signaling ending under Chairman Walsh, investors are being forced to price in actual volatility and term premium rather than just waiting for a press release to tell them what to do.
Investors in regional banks and transport stocks need to finalize their hedges before the market fully prices in this shift. Keep a close eye on energy price volatility, because any sudden spike in oil could break the Fed's inflation-focused stability and kill the momentum in this broader trade. But if the cost of energy stays low, does that mean we're heading toward a period of permanent stability, or are we just waiting for the next geopolitical shock to blow the whole thing up? I'm increasingly convinced that energy security has become a polite euphemism for playing a high-stakes game of maritime musical chairs.
It's more than just a game, Maya. It's a structural realignment of global trade where the physical movement of molecules is being weaponized by regulatory shifts in trade agreements.
We're looking at a future where we face skyrocketing fuel costs, a total collapse of the renewable transition, and a sudden, inexplicable shortage of AA batteries.
While the battery bit is a stretch, the energy volatility is very real. If you look at Taiwan, the vulnerability is extreme. They rely on imports for 97% of their energy, and since the completion of their nuclear phase-out in May 2025, they've been left with an 11-day LNG reserve limit.
And they've essentially signed a massive check to the Trump administration to fix it, right?
The February 2026 Reciprocal Trade Agreement commits Taiwan to $44.4 billion in U.S. LNG and crude purchases through 2029. This creates a massive fiscal burden for Taiwan, which is already reeling from losses of NT$418 billion. Chinatalk noted that Taiwan's electricity pricing actually functions as a hidden tool of monetary policy. By freezing rates at 12 cents per kWh to suppress inflation, the government is effectively subsidizing fossil fuels and making renewables economically non-competitive.
The green transition is being choked by the very bills meant to keep the lights on.
It's even more precarious than that. Chinatalk also flagged that a Chinese blockade wouldn't even need kinetic missiles. The PLA could use regulatory gray zone tactics, like imposing arbitrary maritime permits on energy vessels, to strangle the island's supply.
And we can't even rely on the Middle East to act as a buffer because the Strait of Hormuz is becoming a glorified, high-cost parking lot.
That's exactly what's happening. Bloomberg Surveillance reported a new normal is emerging for Persian Gulf logistics, a high-cost ferry service model where tankers shuttle oil to waiting vessels outside the strait to avoid Iranian interference. This is driving the UAE to consider massive infrastructure shifts, like new pipelines, to bypass the strait entirely if U.S. maritime security wavers.
It sounds like the entire global supply chain is just one administrative error away from a total blackout.
The silver lining, if you can call it that, is the potential for a massive oil glut. If China's demand doesn't return to the 4 to 5 million barrels per day levels we've seen previously, traders are predicting prices could drop to $50 or lower by the end of 2026. Bloomberg Surveillance also noted that because the ability to transact in U.S. dollars has transformed Iranian crude into a competitive, free-floating market barrel, it's exerting significant downward pressure on global prices.
We have a tug-of-war between a massive supply glut and the massive energy appetite of the AI revolution.
That's the central tension. Tani Fukui warned that achieving a 2% inflation target will be difficult because the massive energy demand from AI-driven computing power creates new, sustained price pressures that could offset any decline in broader energy costs.
Energy traders should start hedging for a period of extreme, unpredictable volatility.
Keep a close eye on the 2027 strategic stockpile levels. If that projected 4 million barrel per day surplus is absorbed into reserves rather than hitting the market, the price collapse we're all expecting might never happen.
But if the cost of energy stays this unpredictable, it's going to change how companies structure their very survival strategies. I don't know, Alex. This whole new era of corporate finance sounds less like an evolution and more like a slow-motion heist, where the perpetrators are just using more expensive-sounding terminology.
You're talking about the shift in private equity and the resurgence of the LBO model.
I'm talking about LBO maxing. It sounds like a much more aggressive version of optimization, but it feels like just a way to dress up debt loading as innovation.
It's not just a way to dress it up, the mechanics have fundamentally changed. As Behind the Money highlights, the modern LBO maxing strategy uses aggressive debt structures to achieve near-impenetrable, near-zero equity risk, where the initial capital is essentially recouped instantly through management fees charged to the acquired company. It's a shift from restructuring companies to simply managing the fees.
So instead of fixing a broken business, you just charge the broken business for the privilege of being owned by you.
We can trace that further, the scale is massive. We've seen the industry move from being an outsider force to these massive, bureaucratic asset managers. This expansion has pushed private equity into the very guts of the economy, housing, care homes, even water systems, as a result of that post-2008 spending spree.
Which sounds great for the balance sheets of these firms, but terrifying for anyone who actually needs a house or clean water.
The systemic risk is real. Behind the Money noted that the rise in corporate leverage is eroding global stability by shrinking the pool of highly resilient AAA-rated companies from hundreds in the 1980s to only about 6 or 7 today. This creates a fragility trap where a single macro shock can cause a chain reaction of collapses because the creditworthiness just isn't there anymore.
And yet, we're seeing this massive influx of capital into these private markets, as if the scarcity of good deals is the only thing keeping prices up.
That's the problem. Jay Ritter suggests that the massive capital inflows into PE and venture capital have likely eroded the illiquidity premium. Investors are paying more for assets that don't offer that extra scarcity return anymore.
So the premium is a ghost.
It might be, but there's a new mechanism coming. Monetary Matters with Jack Farley discussed how offshore perpetual futures for unlisted companies are emerging as a price discovery tool. This could force companies to abandon the stay private strategy because they'll finally have to face public market-style valuation drops.
So the volatility washing trick, using stale, self-determined marks to hide the actual risk, might actually run out of places to hide.
It's also changing the credit landscape. We're seeing a structural shift in preferred securities. While bank preferreds are seeing net redemptions, the utility sector is flooding the market with hybrid issuance to fund AI and data center expansions. This is actually broadening the investor base, bringing in pensions and endowments.
So we're trading bank debt for utility debt, but the total amount of leverage in the system remains the same.
The composition is changing, but the underlying capital expenditure is massive.
Institutional investors need to closely monitor the credit spreads on these new utility hybrids to see if they actually reflect fundamental strength or just new layers of debt. Watch for any sudden spike in defaults within the utility sector's recent hybrid issuances, as that would signal the fragility trap is finally springing. But as the markets get more complex, the real battle might move from the balance sheet to the courtroom, where new legal precedents are starting to reshape how power is distributed. $1.2 billion. That is the scale of President Trump's recent earnings from crypto and meme coin ventures like World Liberty Financial. It is a number that makes traditional presidential book deals look like pocket change, and it sets a wild stage for what we're discussing today, the shifting landscape of U.S. judicial precedent and the new mechanics of presidential power.
It's not just about the personal wealth, Maya. It's about the regulatory environment that surrounds it. We are seeing a fundamental reconfiguration of how the executive branch interacts with the federal bureaucracy. Following the Supreme Court's ruling in the Slaughter case, the legal barrier between the White House and independent agencies like the FTC and EPA has effectively collapsed.
The independent agencies are now more like department branches.
Worth noting, Paul Krugman noted that this ruling creates a mechanism for presidential corruption. By removing the legal independence of these agencies, the president can now direct mandates toward personal or political interests. Unlike the Federal Reserve, which the court preserved just enough to prevent a total market meltdown, agencies like the FTC have selective enforcement power. This means the administration can specifically target or favor certain corporations based on their loyalty.
So if a company plays ball, they get a pass on antitrust or environmental hurdles, and if they don't, they get the full weight of the law.
That is the causal chain. The president uses the agency to reward specific mergers or waive regulations, which incentivizes corporations to fund political interests in exchange for that regulatory leniency. It's a feedback loop where regulatory manipulation becomes a tool for political and financial enrichment.
It sounds like the backdoor is wide open.
It is.
As the Journal reported, the administration has been using the Supreme Court's emergency docket as a backdoor to bypass lower court injunctions. This has allowed for the rapid implementation of second-term policies, ranging from mass deportations to significant cuts in federal research.
But wait, I thought the court blocked some of that. I heard the birthright citizenship executive order didn't fly.
That was a rare win for the opposition. In Trump v. Malaysia, the court split 6-3 to reject the end of birthright citizenship. However, the legal victory is precarious. Brett Kavanaugh's concurrence in that case created a massive legislative opening. He ruled that while the president cannot use an executive order to change citizenship rules, Congress retains the power to pass statutes that create new exceptions.
So the battle just moves from the Oval Office to the Senate floor.
While the court is simultaneously solidifying conservative pillars regarding campaign spending and gender-based sports regulations, the structural power of the presidency is expanding through these specific judicial carve-outs.
It's a high-stakes game of regulatory chess, and the rules are being rewritten in real time.
And the implications for global markets are massive, especially as this model of populist governance begins to influence other regions.
Institutional investors need to reevaluate their exposure to U.S. industries heavily reliant on FTC or EPA oversight. Watch for the next major merger announcement in the tech or energy sectors to see if it defies traditional antitrust scrutiny. As we wrap up this July 1st edition, the common thread across everything we've discussed today, from the trillion-dollar hyperscaler capex to the shifting judicial landscape in the wake of Trump v. Malaysia, is the collapse of the distinction between digital innovation and physical reality. We are witnessing the end of a world where software could scale infinitely without being tethered to energy grids, silicon supply chains, or the political whims of administrative agencies.
The overarching implication here isn't just that markets are rotating, but that the fundamental calculus for the Treasury and the Federal Reserve has fundamentally shifted. It is no longer enough for policymakers to manage interest rates and inflation. They are now forced to manage the physical bottlenecks of a fragmented world. The decision maker to watch is no longer just the Fed chair, but the architects of industrial policy and energy procurement. If the massive capital commitments required to sustain the AI buildout begin to clash with the reality of our 11-day LNG reserves or the rising fiscal deficits, the risk shifts from a mere valuation correction to a systemic liquidity squeeze.
It's a transition from managing intangible growth to managing the very atoms that enable it.
And the way we confirm whether this new high-stakes era of industrial-scale finance is sustainable is by watching the next round of quarterly energy infrastructure spending reports. If we see capital deployment accelerating while energy price stability falters, it will signal that the spend-or-die phase of the AI arms race is officially decoupling from our actual capacity to power it.
We'll be back tomorrow to see if the fundamentals can keep up with the ambition. Thanks for joining us.